Hey, everyone, welcome back to Authentic Avenue. Today, my guest is Jeff Rochester. He's the founder of GRC Advising. He's a pioneer in the world of sustainability, ESG, driving purpose. I say a lot of these buzzwords, but we focus on the show about how to make sure these words don't achieve buzzword status. Jeff has led marketing everywhere across big CPG, media entertainment, the pipe for that media, and now into content, doing it industry agnostic. Today, we talk about the future of the CMO seat and the chief sustainability officer seat. We talk about posturing versus making genuine progress when you see these reports on sustainability and being better for the world. We talk about authenticity and his definition for that. A bunch of great topics. He's passionate about this and he's no BS. So I can't wait to have you hear it and see it. I will sit back and let you do so. This is Jeff Rochester. But I am here with Jeff Rochester, who is a pioneer in helping brands become more purpose-driven. I mean, I know I've talked about that before, and frankly, I even get a little skeptical of what truly is purpose-driven. How do you do it? Are people just posturing? And I have questions about all of that today. Jeff's a real deal, and I know that because I talked to people earlier this year, and you listeners and now viewers saw interviews that I did with Jonathan Webb from AppHarvest, with Romain Leo from Adore Me. Both of those organizations supported and driven by Jeff in this regard. So first off, Jeff, welcome to Authentic Avenue. Thank you for taking a walk with me for these few minutes. How are you?
I'm great and looking forward to our chat.
Good. Me too. Because I feel like I have already been a part of the things that you've influenced, and now I get to hear it from the source. So GRC Advising is something that you have started. And at first I was thinking, like, what is GRC? It's like, duh, Jeff Rochester. So explain to me first, and let's just level set with that. What's GRC all about? And then I got like a ton of detailed questions behind that about all of these words, authenticity being one of them, purpose, sustainability. But we'll get into the weeds in a second. Let's start. What's GRC?
So thanks again for hosting me. And before I get into GRC, let me just take you back. And the audience may know my bio, but it's relevant to GRC. So I was born in Barbados. My dad was a diplomat to the UN. I grew up in D.C., in New York, and then D.C., did Georgetown Wharton. And then my career has been a very enjoyable, challenging journey through marketing. I started in packaged goods, which is where everyone says you should start, the OG of brand management, with Procter. Then I was in the travel sector. I ran marketing for Radisson. I ran marketing for Comcast. I worked in marketing for Showtime. I ran marketing for WWE. So if you just look back at that body of work, that's CPG, that's travel and hospitality, that's media and entertainment, the pipe, Comcast, and then content provider, Showtime and World Wrestling. And then I made a huge pivot and worked at the Nature Conservancy for about 10 years as their CMO and then a managing director. And that work informs a lot of GRC. So when you look at GRC, we're industry agnostic. We're a consulting firm. We're an advisory. I don't like to think of us as an ad agency. We get really in there. We work with the CEO or the founder. We represent Adam brands, for-profit and not-for-profit brands. And we work in two areas, actually. We work in marketing and branding. And we also work in financial strategies. If they're looking to raise capital, et cetera, we advise them on their financial strategies. I've got a great team. Akash, who you know, is out of Miami, formerly New York, formerly London. Then there's a guy, Chris, in London. There's a guy in Argentina. And then we've got a team of about 18 people that come in and out that help support across PR, project management, social media, ESG, et cetera. So that's the team. And it's about getting brands and nonprofits to tell a better story and have greater impact around social purpose.
Hmm. Well, I like that because that's been my mission in my own little way for the past several years. Now, it's been focused around one little word to me, authenticity. I've blown that out as far as I can do it. And I know that you have expertise and perspective there as well. And viewers, by the way, like if you're going and listening to this and just clicking GRC website and all that, they got a great team. They got some of the best networkers out there. They got some of the best people out there. And so quick plug for that. But you mentioned that you have led, captained the ship for a lot of these fantastic brands in all different sorts of industries. starting in big CPG. I know that's where a lot of great marketers get their start, to some of the best marketers in the world. Frankly, WWE is part of that. I'd love to have Stephanie on this show at some point. That's just me speaking from my CMO experience, because I think that they are great. I don't care if you like wrestling or not. You probably don't market better than them. And so now you are focused on this purpose-driven perspective. You've described your journey as gone from having sold Cheetos to this. And I have seen that illustrated as two ends of a spectrum. And so I want to start here because, like, obviously, like, purpose, sustainability, big, big things, ESG, I think there's a real risk that they get buzzwordy. And I want to ask about that in a second. So today, when you see like a big investment bank, a BlackRock, or a firm, or even a Frito-Lay, because they do this too now, coming out with reports every year on their sustainability initiatives, what they're doing, you're one of the OGs here. You're a pioneer. You know if they're BSing or not, because you've marketed for all those sorts of organizations before. Is this truly meaningful progress, or is some of this just posturing to look good until they finally actually get it right and can walk the talk?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite topics, and I get asked this a lot, formally at conferences, informally at cocktail parties at my local bar at Williamsburg.
Yeah, I'm sure it's just like an elbow thing. It's like, come on, are they really?
Right.
They really?
And so I give these companies a lot of leeway. Look, I believe in capitalism. Capitalism is not perfect. You know, we've talked about the failure of the healthcare system with COVID, with capitalism and Black Lives Matter. There's a lot of critiques of capitalism, as there should be. But I believe in the institution. I believe it should be evolved, not destroyed, and start over. And so I take the same view to purpose, ESG, SDG. I give these brands and businesses a lot of leeway in that. I just want to see them start on a journey. I don't expect them to get it perfect out of the gate. I think we should give them credit when they try. And I think when we have this like zero tolerance, like the first time they make a mistake, we want to crucify them. We had the case with Gillette when they tried to do, was it Gillette?
Their Me Too thing, I'm sure is what you're talking about.
Well, so about 2 years ago, I think it was Gillette did a campaign about men and boys, and they were much criticized. Yep. And we all remember the Pepsi Kendall Jenner ad that was much
gotten memed into oblivion. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what I don't want is, if you were a CMO contemplating doing something like that, and you see the Gillette headline and you see the Pepsi headline and you duck and cover, I don't want that. I want people to realize that these brands are big behemoths. This is a new skill. They will get it right. One of the reasons why I'm so confident, the employees will make them get it right. Forget about public markets and external criticism. You talk to any 25-year-old. They are very focused on these topics. And these 25-year-olds are growing into these 32-year-olds that would be VPs, EVPs, et cetera. So I see the systemic change as happening. Yes, people will be inauthentic, but I think well-intentioned. And they will get it right over time. But it's not going to happen. You know, if you've ever worked with any brand, you're launching, you know, the first launch of broadband, the first launch of HDTV. How perfect was that marketing message? It took years to get it right, to really convey the value proposition to the consumer. So I treat it the same way as with any new communications, as with any new branding strategy. How many people get it perfect out of the gate? New Coke, right? New Coke, legendary failure.
1985 is the most recognizable ad campaign.
Right. And yet that's from an OG. Trust me, Coke knows what the fuck they're doing. And they blew that, right?
So
I look at this the same way. I am hopeful. I'm optimistic. I give people a lot of credit. What gives me confidence? It's inevitable. They will figure it out or they will die, right? Because the consumers aren't having it. So this is a very different conversation than 6 years ago, where it was kind of a go, no go. From my lens, what I've seen is every chief sustainability officer, every chief impact officer, every head of a foundation, they were alone and no one cared 6 or 7 years ago. They were off doing their thing. The CEO cared. The CMO, like, I don't want any part of this. I want Beyonce in my ads. I don't want to talk about social purpose. I don't want to talk about supply chain and traceability and these issues.
Sure.
Now the CMOs want it. And they're playing defense because their consumers are demanding it. Or they're playing offense and they want to deposition their competitors by leading. Right. Mm-hmm. So now the conversation is different because the CMOs have the tools, they have the skills, and they have the budgets. So all of them are struggling, to be clear, they're struggling with how to build this into the brand platform. But what I love is it's now moving into the brand platform. It's no longer on the periphery.
I agree. It's good that it's moving from the periphery to center stage. Brings a power dynamic up that I want to talk about in a second.
Right.
Because you mentioned that 6 years ago, people really weren't caring about this. But somewhere, you were. I got a quote from you from 7 years ago. Now, I've been in the professional world post-college for 7 years. Okay, just started year number 8. And the entire time, in fact, most of that time, I was working across the street from you when you were at Nature Conservancy.
Right.
In my first year, 2014, you made a quote to Sustainable Brands, which I know you're also a big part of. And you were talking specifically about the environmental movement. And today I know a lot of 25-year-olds, they care deeply about that. I still know there's a gap between those that care about it and those who say they're environmentalists. But regardless, there's a sea change moving in that direction. At that time, you made a quote, and the quote is this. I'm going to read this off. The environmental movement will fail if we are not able to engage broader audiences. We're narrow cast. We're reaching just a certain percentage of the population, and we need to build a big tent of support for environmental issues. Okay, that's 7 years ago. A lot has changed since then. People care more about this. Where is that big tent propped up today, other than you and what you all are doing? Where have you seen that different?
Yeah, let me jump in. So much of my thinking on the NGO space and the environmental space comes out of Nature Conservancy. Very large organization, very smart people, one of the largest environmental groups in the world. And what I love is they're on the ground in every state. They have state offices there in 70 countries. So they know the pulse. They don't come up with big, ubiquitous, one-size-fits-all solutions. Mm-hmm. How you talk about climate change in Texas is going to be different than how you talk about it in San Francisco. So they get those differences. And when I joined them in 2010, it was under the Obama administration, and we still couldn't get federal legislation done on climate change. And there's a guy, Glenn Prickett, who was their head of policy back then, and he said, Jeff, failure of national legislation on climate change was a failure of scientists talking to politicians, comma, nobody was talking to the American public, exclamation point. And so things have changed, but in 2010, in 2005, when Gore was talking and people were ringing the bell, beware, climate change is coming, they were talking up here. They were talking 2 degrees of change. In 50 years, they were talking about pandas on ice floes. Like, no one cared, right?
Yep.
There's a group that I'll plug, Eco America. They've been following messaging. They're like the marketing research arm of the environmental community, Eco America. And they've been warning about this also. And the warning is, back then and even today, you can take a scientist and pop them into a red state, let's be blunt, and that scientist wants to talk about climate change. I don't know if that community is going to listen to that scientist. But if their preacher or minister talks to them, if their local doctor, GP talks to them, they're more likely to listen to those audiences. So here's another statistic that was prevalent in 2010, and is probably still prevalent today. It's grown. Two statistics, actually. When you look at all philanthropic giving, Adam, all philanthropic giving, it's about $400 billion. Back then, it was probably $340. The environment gets 2 to 3% of all that giving. Now, one would argue clean air, clean water affects 100% of any population. But religion, sure. Religion gets 33 cents on a dollar. Arts gets more. Housing gets more. Education gets more donations than the environment. Because historically, the environment is narrow casting. You know, I've always said if you personify the environmental movement, is that person at a cocktail party? And this is a former trend. It's better today. But certainly in 2000, 2005, 2010, the environmental movement's reputation, if you personified it, is that person at a cocktail party you don't want to talk to. Because when you drive up, they're going to tell you, they're going to scold you. You drove up in the wrong car. You're wearing the wrong clothes. You're using the wrong plate and fork. You're drinking the wrong beer. You're eating the wrong food, right? So when you hear that movement is only getting donations, you know, is only 3% of the pie of all donations, they'll say, that's wrong.
Yep.
And it's a failure of messaging and targeting, right? So I've always felt that anything you believe in, you need to move mountains to make sure you're meeting people where they are. We would kid around back then in 2010 that the movement needed NASCAR drivers as messengers in the States. They needed Sarah Palin, right, as messengers. They don't need Jack Black and David Letterman, because you're only going to talk to 50% of the population.
Right.
So fast forward to answer your question directly, how do you build that big tent? You build it by unusual partners. Look, at Nature Conservancy, we work with REI and Patagonia. No argument, we should. I love doing deals with Subway. Mm-hmm. I love doing deals with Macy's. I love doing deals with Harley Davidson. These are not brands you associate with the environmental movement. Harley Davidson is incredibly philanthropic. We had a deal with them, people are like, what? What's that all about, right? But yet, are they not worthy? The fact that I'm riding around in a big-ass motorcycle, gas-guzzling motorcycle in the great outdoors, does that make me a bad person? Do I not want that person part of the conversation, right?
Yeah.
Fast forward, what I loved, 2020 was a year where we found our voices, corporations, influencers, and ordinary people. We found our voices on racial justice with Black Lives Matter. We found our voices on healthcare with COVID. And in fourth quarter, we found our voices on democracy. What does that mean? When LeBron James wears a baseball cap that says vote, that's building a big tent. Mm-hmm. When the Super Bowl in 2018, the guy that was one of the leaders of the host committee. So the Super Bowl in Miami was hosted by the South Florida Super Bowl host committee. They use their voice to talk about sea level rise, right? At a Super Bowl.
So in on a peninsula.
Correct. So part of building the big tent is, yes, my God, sure, preach to the choir, but spend less time preaching to the choir than finding innovative ways to deliver an innovative message in an innovative way from innovative messengers. Right.
Right.
And that's why I love that our society globally is irreparably changed. You see European football clubs talking about race. Mm-hmm. Right. You mm-hmm. see American sports talking about climate. These are the ways you build that big tent. And it doesn't need to be preachy, over the top messaging. I've talked to the people that run Avatar. Right. I love, you know, when I was at Nature Conservancy, I would call their brand team every year and say, I wanted Nature Conservancy to be a philanthropic partner for Avatar. Go see the movie. Donate to Nature Conservancy. If you're out there, Avatar, I still think that's a great idea. They would tell me the following, Adam, every year. They said, yes, we agree with you, Jeff. This $2 billion asset, this piece of content is one of the biggest public service announcements in history for the environment, but we don't want to screw it up. And if we added more preachy messaging, people would tune out.
Okay.
But light, people engaging, And the messaging will happen. So that's a long-winded answer, but I'm very passionate about this big tent thing. I think that, you know, I was happy when in this country the environmentalists moved to talk about jobs and stop talking about, you know, pandas.
Yep. Right. Now you get to lead the charge within that tent and making sure that you're meeting people where you are. Man, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that from CMOs over the last couple of months. I mean, that's even a new term or phrasing that I have heard. That's where I want to go next. Talk about that power dynamic a little bit ago. I have spoken to hundreds of chief marketing officers, industry agnostic, just like the way that you work. And for the longest time, and maybe it's still that way, I had witnessed it. It's obvious the statistics line up with the fact that CMO tenures have shrunk over time. I feel like a lot of time they become the scapegoat for broader problems, or, oh, it's all branding, we need to change the branding. And maybe part of that is true, but maybe part of it is that they're not getting the right buy-in at the executive table. They need to find a better seat. Well, chief sustainability officer might have been in that seat that wasn't getting paid attention to 6-7 years ago when people were concerned about putting Beyonce into the commercial. Maybe now they're doing it, but maybe she's wearing a hat that says something else. So where I saw that struggle before between the CMO and maybe the CFO or something like that, I wonder if it will exist between CMOs and these CSOs, chief sustainability officers, because now the stuff that they cared about for so long, they didn't get any attention, microphone time, now is, my guess is that CMOs are going to want to get into that seat. What does that do to the CSO role? I'm curious, because does it combine? Does it stay separate? Like, where do you see that going?
Yeah, here's the harsh reality. And I've been talking to people like Sustainable Brands and other groups about this for 10 years. When the CMOs grab this, get out of the way. You're not going to win. So the best thing someone who's got the word impact, social responsibility, sustainability attached to their name, the best thing they can do is partner with that CMO. Mm-hmm. Don't believe in a heartbeat that you're going to be able to keep your lane. So here's another interesting example. I don't like all the new titles that they've come up with in marketing. Now they make it seem like digital and regular marketing are separate. And so
I was frankly confused by marketing and brand too. I was like, isn't that the
yeah,
same thing?
Exactly. Anyway. Exactly. So people love to play around with these titles. I'm a purist and I'm an old guy. So, you know, when people talk about shared value and all this stuff, that's stakeholder theory, right? So at the macro level for a publicly traded company, there's this notion of stakeholders, of which shareholders are one, right? Okay. Your employees are another stakeholder. Your community is the third stakeholder. So when people talk about shared value and all these things changing, no, we've had a construct for decades. It's called shareholder theory. And I mean, stakeholder theory. And what's happened is the shareholders have become overweighted, right? There's this notion of marketing and brand, right? Which is all of this. And so when people say, well, you're no longer a CMO, what we really value is a chief revenue officer. What the fuck is a CMO doing? They're driving revenue, right? So in the same way, I would argue impact, like, so is a CMO not an impact officer? You need right. a separate impact person? I think the best thing that can happen is my framework is these are issues, the foundation, sustainability, ESG, SDG. These are all things that were viewed narrowly outside of the traditional brand.
Right.
And all we're saying nowadays is if you're Nike, if you're Google, if you're Pepsi, how does your brand relate to those things? And the keeper of that flame is the CMO. So if I were these other areas, and I've seen this for 3 years, people would tell me literally, you know, Jeff, I'm the fill in the blank, head of corporate social responsibility, chief sustainability officer. I was scheduled to speak at a conference. The CMO came in over the top of me, threw some dollars at the conference for a sponsorship, and they got my speaking gig or they got yep. my attention. They're never going to win that battle, right? And in a way, I'm kind of happy that the CMOs now care, regardless of why they care.
Sure.
Right? So it may be sloppy and a little ugly short term, but I think there will be an elegant solution over time where the CMO take these other areas, whether they report to them or not, and put them under their wing, right? In a gracious way, not in a competitive way, in a gracious way. I think that's what will happen. It may be bumpy along the way, but it's inevitable because look, people don't want to hear about a shoe company called Nike that doesn't care, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And figuring out what that means is the purview of the chief marketing officer working with these other departments.
Gotcha. Okay. So if you're out there, you're a chief sustainability officer today, go partner with your CMO. I wonder, actually, let me ask corollary to that. Should they aim to like become a CMO because they know that that's where the power is going?
Well, great question. So here's an example for all of your audience. Someone I adore, have massive respect for, Bea Perez, Coke. I think she's technically their chief sustainability officer. She came from marketing. I think she was their CMO. And Muhtar Kent, their chairman, about 8 years ago, had the presence of mind to move her over because he knew this was coming. Hmm. And I'm sure he wanted someone leading sustainability who knew the company really well, was a marketing genius, and can find that point of integration. So she tackles that job unlike any CSO in the world, right? She brings the full force of marketing and branding of Coca-Cola, and she brings the air cover of the chairman. Now, things have changed. I don't even know if she's still there. I think Muhtar has moved on. But that was one of the first times where I saw someone flip the narrative
yep.
as to what that sustainability role could be.
I should go get her. I'll bring her on the show.
Well, no, I'd be happy to. I mean, she partnered with Will.i.am on some stuff. She partnered with Burberry on some stuff. She was killing it. Again, I'm not current, but.
Right. Well, I'll go and help. I'll go and do some research. Listeners, go check her out, what she's doing right now. I want to ask about some of your more recent work, Jeff, because I know from firsthand experience that you've done a hell of a lot with AppHarvest. You've done a hell of a lot with Adore Me. That's just from my interviewing experience. So I know ag tech, very important. Fashion, very important. You're moving those industries forward. I'm curious to know what industries you see out there, since you're industry agnostic, desperately need change the most towards the way that you are helping these ag tech and fashion brands move forward.
Let me launch. I just had the pleasure. I was invited by iSelect, an ag tech fund, to speak at a conference called Crusonia, CRU Crusonia, last week. And what they were advocating for, so their sector is ag tech, they're a financial company, but yep. they also invest in health tech. And they live at the intersection between the two worlds. What does that mean? The conference, Adam, was focused on the following statistics. We as a country spend $1.7 trillion in all types of food, ag, et cetera, grocery, retail, you know, wholesale, whatever, food, $1.7 trillion. We as a country spend $1.9 trillion in healthcare for diseases that are preventable through diet. We do not connect the two, right? So that's $3.5+ trillion, right? That someone argues being used inefficiently. When's the last time you heard anyone talk about COVID and talk about the role of diet in preventing COVID? We talk about vaccines. We talk about masks. We talk about social distancing. Diet is not a part of the COVID conversation. Should be. Only 10% of Americans eat enough fruits and vegetables. 10%. So if you're in the ag tech space, think of the volume opportunity. If we could get 3 out of 10 Americans to eat more fruits and vegetables, it would triple the available size of the market for the ag tech sector. Right. So what I see is I see a revolution coming in healthcare. One of the groups that I've come to know and respect is Appalachian Regional Health in Kentucky. They're the largest healthcare system in Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia. They have 13 hospitals, 90 clinics. Their CEO, Holly, is terrific. I was with her last week. And I think the notion of reinventing how we think of healthcare and the inclusion of diet, and we're starting to see it. I was at my doctor the other day, and I was pleasantly surprised where in addition to some medications, he had recommended chamomile tea and some other kind of, you know, diet-based solutions. So I think that there will become a tipping point, a flip of the narrative, where there's a lot of pressure and inspiration inflicted on the healthcare community to talk a lot more about diet, nutrition, and exercise. You know, the notion of an unhospital, right? Not an institution that is solely focused or predominantly focused on fixing you when you get in. An institution that has a laser-like focus on how can they help their community not go to the hospital in the first place. And I think, you know, you look at someone like Eric Adams, who is the presumptive next mayor of New York. He's the Brooklyn Borough president, Eric Adams. He had diabetes. He was going blind. He went to a plant-based diet, reversed his symptoms completely, wrote a book about it, and he ran a Democratic primary. And he has a platform around what can this conversation look like in a major urban market, right? You know, Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, has pledged to be one of the greenest cities in the world. What's the role of diet in his vision? So I think there will become a moment in our society, and I think COVID will trigger a lot of this, where we start as a civilization globally and as a society in the U.S. to redefine our expectations of the healthcare community. The U.S. is so shitty on this. A study came out a week or two ago. The U.S. ranked dead last, right? And so I think the notion of understanding is not about more money. It's about how the money is allocated. So I see the healthcare system reinventing how they think about their business model,
yep,
the reward mechanisms from insurance providers, and their obligation to citizens. The last thing I'll say on that is, great example of this conversation when CVS said, done with cigarettes, right? We need more of that.
Sure. You know what's interesting, as you were talking about that, I remembered to what you said earlier in the show, which was that, you know, a while back we were talking about issues related to the environment, and we were talking to only people who really cared. Nobody was really listening. Whereas I see that today, and I know this because in other parts of my podcast world, I'm doing things in plant-based nutrition. I even hear that, and I'm thinking, okay, these are just like vegans talking to vegans, right? They all get it. But how do you spread that message more widely? I wonder if a similar change will happen over the next, and it'll probably be 5 to 7 or 8 years. Unfortunately, it's too slow, but like to become important in these veins that you're talking about. So I think that's really smart. And I'm actually going to go try to find people to bring on the show to talk about that in the healthcare world. So that's very, very interesting. I appreciate that. I got 2 more questions for you. First one, we might have answered already, but I'll go to it because LinkedIn put out an article last week about ESG, and they're always doing that. They also put out a tweet asking its followers to predict what the next business buzzword would be. And you heard a lot of things like AI and hybrid and remote work and digital workforce. I said, and I responded to LinkedIn and tweets that I thought it would be some variation of ESG, some variation of sustainability. And it's just because I don't want it to go that way of like, we know that when we say the word sustainability, people will flock to us because they think that we're doing the right thing. Again, this is back what I said at the beginning. Is it posturing or is it progress? What can big business do to ensure that it doesn't fall victim to buzzword status?
Yeah, I love this because I'm not a big fan of buzzwords. I don't really care. I mean, everyone knows the best marketing in the world is around emotional end benefit, right? And so I think we should get out of our heads with the kind of language. And I use those words also, ESG, SDG. I think we should focus more on the benefit to people, right? How is your ESG strategy at the end of the day going to benefit your customers? And I don't know the elegant answer to that, but the word I would think is normalize. I don't want these to be exceptional, specialized conversations. I want if you're Nike or Google or AppHarvest or Dormy, when you talk about your brand, when you talk about how you serve your customers, you are inherently addressing these issues, but you're not beating your chest talking about ESG. I mean, yeah, that lives on your site, that lives in your annual report. I'll take AppHarvest. AppHarvest is focused on three things: food security, how do you feed 9 billion people? Economic prosperity, their greenhouses, they'll build, you know, 7 greenhouses over the next 5 to 7 years. Each of those will probably employ 300 to 500 people. That's meaningful difference. That's changing somebody's life, right? In a region that lost 50,000 jobs.
Yeah.
And third, they're increasingly focused on advocating for nutrition's preventative health. Now, I just said all that. And I didn't say SDG or ESG, right?
Sure.
So I'm more interested in brands telling stories about how they plan on helping people in their lives than using the words ESG or SDG or Benefit Corp or any of these things. Yes, we can all do a better job of educating the consumer about these terms, but in the end of the day, people are busy. They're worried about their kids not getting COVID or getting their kids through school or their relationship with their wife or their job. And I think we shouldn't like be overly focused on these terms.
Me neither. That's why I was so fearful of it becoming buzzword status, because I felt that that happened a little bit, and hopefully it's passed, with the word that I've obsessed with over the last couple of years, which is authenticity, right? I was like, shoot, is that going to become... I had the... Whatever. I'll say it because you could look at a previous podcast. Linda Boff, the CMO of GE, told me that in 2019, middle of 2019, she thought that was becoming a dirty word. The A word is what she called it. And I was a little shook because I thought, damn, am I focusing on something that's just going to get elevated or maybe decreased to buzzword status? But I think that by normalizing regular discussions about issues, about progress, that like authenticity simply becomes a lens. And that's my idea of it. But I want to close with this question because I do ask everybody what they think about the word, specifically how they define it. Reason is because I think I'm going to probably write a one-word dictionary someday about this word. Because I've talked to so many people about it, and I've never heard of the concept of a one-word dictionary, so I'm fascinated. So if I asked you, Jeff, to close this out, if you turn to your own personal dictionary and turn to the page that had the word authenticity on it, what would that definition read?
I would replace authenticity with natural. The exposition of all this stuff in the brand needs to feel natural. It can't seem forced. It can't seem artificial. So that's got to be natural. It's got to be like breathing air. You can't be like tying yourselves up in knots to make the fit between the brand and what it is you're talking about. So I have a very easygoing approach to this stuff. You know, it's funny when you think of the null hypothesis of some of these concepts. So are you saying you want to be an inauthentic brand? No shit. Like brands want to be, they want to make sure whatever it is they're talking about is aligned with who and what the brand really is. I mean, authenticity permeates any brand from the logo to how it manifests on the website to the topics that they talk about in an all hands internal meeting. Authenticity is obvious. I never use the word authentic.
Interesting. I love that answer because, you know, I use the word in this sort of medium, in this conversation. I don't really use it too much in my regular speaking world. I'll use words like, you know, not organic, but definitely, you know, natural, real. I just
use the word real is a good word. You know, but again, I don't think there's a CMO in the world where it's up in the morning thinking, oh, you know, I want to be inauthentic.
No, of course. Yeah, right.
Right. So of course that's the goal. That is the true north for any brand, any business. And look, and what I love is the new power dynamic is that when I grew up in business, I didn't think I could police anything that my company did, right? If I'm working for a big Fortune 500. The kids that work in these companies today are internal quality control. They're the first ones that will call BS on inauthenticity. So the whole internal pressure that was not as prevalent in American business, certainly 10 or 15 years ago, that is absolutely relevant today.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm glad to have had a real conversation with you about this sort of thing, about the posturing versus the progress, about where the CMO seat is going versus the CSO seat. That Big Ten, I'm glad it's been built up over the last 7 years. Sorry that I didn't talk to you when you were across the street, but I'm glad that I've got you across the screen now. And for all of it, Jeff, thanks very much for joining me. I really appreciated it.
Adam, my pleasure.
I really appreciated that chat because Jeff is a true pioneer here. He sees things years in advance. And I think his comment there at the end about healthcare is really important. Yeah, I mean, 5, 6, 7 years ago, even 15 years ago, talking about the environment was basically talking to scientists. You weren't communicating with everybody, and you sort of looked at them with a skeptical eye, like, is that really a problem? The same persists today with diet and nutrition, especially those who are plant-based, talking about veganism and things like that. And I wonder if what Jeff is saying is going to come true. We'll have to wait probably 5, 6, 7 years for it. But in the meantime, I'm glad to have brought that perspective to you because he's no bullshit. You saw that. And I'm glad that I saw it as well. So I'm going to come back with another episode here real soon. Here's what you could do in the meantime. I'm on LinkedIn, Authentic Avenue, Adam Connor. You can subscribe or follow wherever you're watching or consuming this across podcast mediums or YouTube or LinkedIn or wherever. Write me an email, adam@authav.com, AUTHAVE.com. And, you know, ask me questions. Tell me what you're thinking about the show. Say, Adam, I hate this. Do whatever you want. And I will respond. I'll do my best. Until then, I will be back with another show shortly. And so to sign off, until the next time I get real again with you, thank you for taking a walk with me today down Authentic Avenue. See you later.